This is the Cybersecurity Amplified and Intensified podcast. Today we're here with Todd Kane of Evolve Management. Hey Todd, how's it going?
Hey guys, good to be here.
So tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I've been in the MSP industry for, I guess, a couple of decades now. Originally, I was a VP of operations for a large, recognizable Canadian MSP. Kind of took them from the post-merger hangover, doubled in headcount, doubled in revenue, increased gross margin, and slashed turnover. Kind of recognized the tools that I was using in the industry pretty universal. There was no sort of secret sauce to the individual companies that I was working in and making improvements in. So I decided to go back to my consulting roots, and now I'm a consultant to MSPs and IT service providers to increase margin, provide more profit and less stress for the owners and operators of MSPs.
So what are you seeing out in the market these days with your clients? How are they handling not just the growth or the constriction of business because of recent events, but the cybersecurity aspect of things?
Yeah, the growth has been interesting because in one hand, there is a lot of business that is starting to turn around. IT kept the lights on through the coronavirus pandemic, but it also created a lot of sort of stress events. Increase in demand, people saw kind of a 30 to 40% rise in workloads and support requests through the beginning of the pandemic, and then it sort of tailed off and got even from there. But there was a sort of a surprising increase in business. So I know one group that was adding, 7 clients a month, and at one point added 15 clients in a 3-week period. So there's a sort of a have and a have not type of situation going on, and the operators that are able to sort of stay on top of it and are able to onboard and are still able to market in some capacity have really done well, which is, I guess, been a bit surprising. There's also been some challenges, though. I think what we're going to start to see going forward is a real strong competition for talent, because what the pandemic has proven is what I've always suggested is that people can work remotely if you manage them correctly. And that, I think, that was sort of the missing piece of this. Like I have this expression that visibility does not equal productivity, because bad operators always had this thing in their head where, like, I need to be able to see my staff to make sure that they're busy, which is the furthest thing from the truth. Like, it makes no difference. What people found is that the productivity actually went up when people were at home, and the quality of life felt better for a lot of other people after things sort of got a little quieter and settled down. But now what we're finding is, if you live in, say, like, rural Nebraska or northern Montana, you can work for an MSP in Texas or California or anything. The boundaries of where you hire people from, I think, are going to get a lot more blurred and are starting to become a bit more blurred. So retention and competition for talent, I think, is going to get really, really hot in the next year or two.
These companies are growing so fast, and some of them that we talk to are really, really struggling just to keep the ones that they got. In fact, I'm a part of a group that you may know called ASCII, mm-hmm. and some of them are talking about where a lot of their contracts are actually coming back to them and say, hey, things are still kind of tight. Can we switch over to T&M block hour type of stuff? So what would you say maybe is the top one or two things that some of these MSPs who are rapidly growing are doing really, really well?
I think being visible. The one that I noted that added a ton of clients in that 3-week period is vertical specific, which is a strategy. It's not necessarily one that I think you want to jump on unnecessarily. A lot of people will tell you, like, you should focus on a single vertical and just be really good at that. But it creates concentration, and then in adverse events, you have a lot more risk on the downside. So I'm not one of those people that says you should hyper specialize if you can. If you have an area of expertise, then great. And I think being visible and continuing to market and making sure that you're adding to the funnel, even if it feels like either you're busy or you're slow. Otherwise, people end up in this sales roller coaster where everything sells at the same time, because there's those panic events where the owner and the salespeople kind of start pounding the pavement because it feels like times are getting dicey. And it's the infrequency of those types of events that cause sort of the onslaught of sales. And I think if people were a bit more consistent with their sales and marketing, being a bit more visible, where wherever they can. And that'll become easier as the markets start to open as well. And, you know, as you guys, I'm sure, where the cybersecurity angle is one that is ever present, right? And becoming, you know, over the last year or two, I think it became much more in sort of the forethought of most average business operators. Before, a lot of people would think, well, you know, I want to protect myself from ransomware and I want to make sure that I have backups. And now the threat is so much more pervasive, and it's really difficult for the average person to wrap their head around what needs to be done in order to protect themselves. So I think that the cybersecurity angle will increasingly become a bit of a differentiator for a lot of the MSP businesses out there, as the sophistication and the understanding of the client base becomes higher, and that just becomes simply a demand and an expectation of the MSP provider.
As we're transitioning, still have a company called IT Simplified, but for many years there, probably about two, we were micro focused. We were doing veterinary clinics, and that's all we did. Like, our whole branding was just veterinarian, and it got really good because, you know, a lot of clinics were able to start coming to us. We were able to start growing really, really well in that space. But anytime we tried to branch out of it, it's like, oh, well, you're really doing this. How are you going to help my accounting, my legal firm, things of that nature? So there is something that MSPs need to realize when they go that micro focus, it can have backlash. Like you hinted on that, I just want to kind of touch on. But the other thing you just touched on that I really want to talk about for a minute is a lot of MSPs are going out there and wanting to be an MSSP.
Yes.
You know, they want to throw that extra S on there, you know, because they're super. But I can't tell you how many times I've got to, like, yo, guys, slow your roll, calm the F down, and talk this thing through. There was a company out there, they're probably still doing it, Resecure Now, is allowing MSPs to resell insurance policies for cybersecurity. But I'm not sure how it is up there in the BC, but a lot of states down here, you have to be a licensed insurance broker to resell a policy through an underwriter. I'm here in South Carolina, it's that way. A couple of people that I know in Michigan and Florida, it's the same way. So they'll just, oh yeah, you can go ahead and do it. You can go ahead and do it. No worries. Just go ahead and do it. And, you know, if something ever happens, good Lord, I hate to see freaking the legal issues that's going to ramification for that thing. I know what my two cents on the matter is, but any MSP that's wanting to throw in that super special S onto their title, what would you tell them from a 30,000 foot view?
I have this conversation pretty regularly, like, because like there feels like a bit of a cash grab moment, and hey, I can add a ton of services and this stuff is good margin. It seems like it's fairly easy to just add some SKUs, add some software to the stack, and now I'm an MSSP. And I agree with you. It's the furthest thing from the truth. Quite frankly, security is a much different type of skill set than it is from traditional IT infrastructure. One, the risks are higher, but it's a lot more like governance than it is like troubleshooting or architecture. And I think that's what people miss, is that you can't just add three different pieces of software and all of a sudden you're an MSSP. Like, there's a lot more that goes into it. And, you know, if you take the time and send someone for the relevant certifications, you know, you start stacking someone towards a CISSP or some a similar industry equivalent, and they actually have the relevant skill set, and you have the staff with the skill set to be able to develop that section of the business, then great. But that's not most MSPs. So what I tend to advise people is just partner with somebody, right? Like, don't try to be everything to everyone, and look for great partners that are MSSPs. They'll do the governance, you do the IT infrastructure. And there's a lot of great partnerships that are working that way. So you don't have to build it on your own, and you certainly can't build it just by adding SKUs and adding pieces of software. And that's what I see is sort of that missing component that people don't qualify or really understand. As far as, you know, whether or not you're going to get into risk management and insurance, I think that's a terrible idea. Like, again, just kind of leave that to the experts. And if you can get a cut of the margin on the resale, great. But don't be the person holding the paper on that policy. That just seems completely unnecessary.
I don't know, man. I think you're going to have a lot of vendors going against you on that one, because they just want to sell more product.
Oh, I 100% agree. And I think that's where it comes from, is the vendors quite rightly are trying to sell solutions. And I don't blame the vendors for this, that these are decent solutions, but they're a component of the puzzle. And I think that's the distinction, is without the governance and the understanding of how to build and secure security infrastructure, you can't just wrap it with software and call it secure. Like that, it just, it leaves an element of risk that is unqualified from a governance standpoint, right?
Absolutely. But, you know, there are vendors out there who will sell you a compliance framework, and they will say, okay, now you can own that risk for your client by giving them this framework or implementing this framework we're selling you. But when you look at the contract that you as a provider sign with your vendor, they assume zero risk. Mm-hmm. So if you're taking that marketing speak from your vendors to your clients and you're pitching them that, yeah, I'm going to be in charge of your systems, I'm like your in-house IT guys, then that causes a transference of risk that most providers don't want. So I guess my question to you is, how do you help your guys, your employees, deal with things like that? Because you and I first came on each other's radar when I was looking for a COO, and that's part of what you do with your consultant. Mm-hmm.
How do you manage the risk profile with the internal staff?
How do you get your clients to understand that just because they are buying a product from a vendor doesn't mean the risk isn't theirs based on how they sell it to their customer? Perfect example, Kaseya has their compliance platform. And back in December, they were selling a CMMC audit plan. CMMC hadn't been finalized up until that point. There were MSPs going to their clients saying, hey, we can get you CMMC certified. I'm not saying Kaseya did it that way, but a lot of the MSPs thought by using Compliance Manager, they would be able to make anyone compliant.
I think that highlights where the risk of this is, you know, how I typically sort of frame this for people is, you want to go out and implement a NIST framework with your clients, or, you know, certainly start with yourself, like secure your own house first, for God's sake. But if you're going to roll out a NIST framework, how do you do that, right? And I get this question a lot, is like, how do I build a security framework? And first, you know, I have a podcast on Evolve Radio with this guy, Gabriel Gump, and he talks about, don't build your own, right? But the difficulty is you go and look at these frameworks, they're not prescriptive. They talk about sort of the 10,000 foot view of the things that you should be securing. Now, if you get into like CIS controls and things like that, there are some better tool sets for helping you implement this stuff. But one, they're extremely rigorous if you actually implement them properly. But broadly, it's just sort of a list of recommendations and things that you should and shouldn't do, which is a good place to start. But that's not being an MSSP. And that's sort of the thing that I try to communicate to people, is that there are definitely some things that you should be doing from a security management and a risk standpoint. But unless you're going to go out and get some type of relevant industry certification, you don't know what you don't know. And I think that is the risk, is if you don't know sort of the proper ways to secure the infrastructure that you're building, the infrastructure that you're absorbing, and then you're just relying on these tool sets to sort of fill in the gaps, that to me is extremely risky. So, you know, again, what I'm communicating to people is that someone has to own this internally, or you leverage a partner so that they understand what the implementation of these frameworks actually looks like, so that you're not sort of doing this in a patchwork capacity that creates a bunch of systemic risk because you think you've done it well, but no one really knows if you've done it well or not, because there's either no internal knowledge or no third party verification of that, right? Like a great example is people that start loading up all kinds of workloads into Azure and or AWS. And the general assumption for kind of low maturity operators from a security standpoint is, the cloud is secure, Microsoft is taking care of this for me. And that's 100% not the case, right? Like, you can load up all kinds of workloads into Azure and make it incredibly insecure if you don't know what you're doing. And that, again, just comes back to the idea of, if you just try to wing it and do the stuff off the side of someone's desk, you're going to end up with a serious headache or something that is actually a business risk. So just don't do it until you have a partner or someone internally that can own this and really understands the security frameworks in detail, not just sort of following a list or some tool set.
From a pen testing standpoint that we handle, we have classes every quarter about breaching cloud infrastructure. There are books written about breaching cloud infrastructure. It's, you know, just because you are in the cloud, just like you said, Todd, does not mean you're secure. The other thing that I want to make note of is, when companies are going through a compliancy, or whatever it is, CMMC, NIST, whatever the case is, each control needs to be thought out clearly. Like we'll take one of them that we went through recently is, are you logging all of your data? Okay, that's a pretty broad freaking statement. So I had to sit back and think about it. It's like, okay, what exactly are they meaning? And then it came to me, it's like, okay, they're talking about my firewall. Where's that log data getting aggregated at? Where's my workstation and my servers? Where's my switches? Where's my cloud infrastructure? Is my RMM and PSA, are those being logged or where are those aggregated? If I'm using other third parties, you know, like TimeZest that's integrated, is there any logging with that? Is there, you know, if you're using a unified controller or a Meraki, or you need to list out your entire stack for each and every control and say, is it applicable? Is there log data? Is there something that you could be able to parse and go through? You know, we beat up another vendor who was actually using a streaming service, and I loaded up Burp Suite just to mess with it a little bit and just kept sending them 2FAs, 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 2FAs. They couldn't figure out where it was coming from. I'm like, I'm over here, guys, you know, just messing around with your API. But the vast things are security. I mean, everybody really needs to start listing out their entire stack of everything that they use and apply it to each and every control. That's the only way you're able to get there. And until you start realizing, wow, this set of software or this solution or this service is really janky, they're not going to change.
Todd, as an operational guy, where do you sit with vendor selection and product selection with your clients?
I tend to have my favorites, I guess, like anyone would. I tend to be kind of cautious, and I tend to leverage partnerships from a security standpoint, especially. But, you know, I tend to suggest people stick close to their ecosystem, I suppose. It tends to make more sense from integration standpoint. I always look at, you know, who has the best APIs, because I'm a big data nerd, and being able to aggregate data into some type of BI tool is particularly important. So from a security standpoint, you know, I'm not necessarily a security guy. I know enough to be dangerous. So from a security selection standpoint, I tend to leverage a lot of trusted partners that act as, say, MDR services from that aspect. And then I kind of have my favorites from a PSA or RMM selection, and then just sort of other tool sets. But I'm also not prescriptive. Like I'll sort of suggest to people, like, here's my favorites and here's why. And if you guys feel differently and this is your selection, that's totally up to you. You know, I don't think that we're in a situation where any of the solutions out there are necessarily bad, because if that were the case, then, you know, there would be some level of industry awareness or evidence towards that. There's sort of fit and fashion. It's much more about how you leverage it, how you use it, how you position it, and whether or not it fits the rest of the ecosystem and what you're leveraging towards in your business, I suppose.
How do you feel about vendors who don't give you any insight into what they're doing into your tenants? That's the biggest issue I have in the MSP space. We have all the auditing for what we're doing with our data, with what we're doing with our client data, and some of these, you know, managed SOC systems or MTR, MDR products, we can't see how their analysts are interacting with the data that we're putting in there. And we don't even know who they are. And if they're offshored, you know, there are security concerns, not necessarily compliance concerns, depending on what yours or your client's vertical is. But how do you feel on the lack of insight and knowledge into what they're doing with our data?
Honestly, I haven't dug enough into it. I've when people are asking about who to use for a security service or an MDR, sort of my first comment is that if on their face, they're kind of indistinguishable, right? So like you really need...
I didn't mean MDR in specifically, and any vendor, like whether it's your PSA, your RMM, QuickBooks, anyone, because especially as we go to the SaaS-based lifestyle, which I think if we're not there, we're going to be there tomorrow. Yep. The vendors have the ability to go in to our tenants and see everything. There's very little that they cannot do with our data. And a lot of them strip it down to a degree and they sell it, which they claim keeps the price down that they charge us or our clients or, you know, down the chain.
Yeah, I think there is an inherent risk to having the keys to the kingdom, right? This is why RMM vendors get a slap on the hand in some cases, where the access vector, like a, you know, control or team viewer, those types of systems have had problems in the past where they've been used as a vector to get into multiple clients, which is risky. There was another vendor that some vendors that I've seen that are leveraging an ad-based model to either reduce cost or make things free, which I've told them I think is a really sort of risky strategy when you're dealing with the privacy and the security concerns that MSPs are subject to, that leveraging an ad-based model seems a little risky. You know, more broadly, this is sort of one of the things that always sort of surprises me about the tech industry. I always ask people in certain circumstances when they're choosing tools and their tech stack of whether or not they're an Apple or an Android person, because to me, it sort of tells me whether or not they're going to like certain vendors or another. But the people that are Android-based and security-minded, maybe I don't know enough, but my suspicions around sort of Android's business model is the leveraging of the data that exists there. But a lot of people still feel like, you know, it's somehow better than Apple's privacy policies in that framework. So I don't know. It's a struggle. You know, there's only so much that you can possibly understand and track in all of these things. And I think that there's a high degree of relevancy around what data access those vendors have and how it's leveraged. And I think they should absolutely expose that, especially if there's any type of resale model.
Now that we've lost all the Fisher-Price fanboys with Apple, let's carry on.
Yes, I'm an Apple fanboy. I run all Apple. And part of it, honestly, is privacy concerns, right? Like, I'm not paranoid about it. But, you know, you look at, like, for example, I bought a new TV and it's an Android TV. And I was like, fine, okay, whatever. But, you know, the people talk about certain software that's pre-installed and it's difficult to remove. And it actively watches what you watch and reports back for ad data, right? And there was a recent software update, and now the top bar is advertising a bunch of content from channels that I don't even have, right? Like Disney Plus stuff is coming up. It's like, come on. Like, I don't need these ads. Like, I paid for this TV. I get it that, you know, I get some improvements in the software, and that's where a lot of this comes from. But, you know, it speaks to the point of, you know, what are the trade-offs of, you know, the cost of this versus, you know, what I'm trading in turn as a product as well, right?
Come on, you know you want to build a snowman.
So from a productivity standpoint, what do you recommend to your clients when you go in? Because I'm sure there's a minimum baseline that you like to see.
Just in how people are managing their internal productivity for staff?
If I were to bring you into my company and say, hey, Todd, you know, you're my COO, get my people into shape. What are your go-to points that you typically do off the bat?
So I have a productivity course, an MSP productivity course that is well liked by the people that have taken it. It's a mixture of sort of a GTD light, getting things done methodology around how to manage your time and your energy. And then there's a second component around making it easier to track your time in the PSA, because, you know, this is sort of the wart on any type of professional services industry. No one likes entering time, and that's a reasonable pushback, but it's also a necessity in our industry where even on fixed base contracts, we're still, our costs are based on time and people. So understanding your costs on a contract and a client basis is incredibly important, even rolling up more broadly to the cost of the company. But if you make it really difficult for people and, you know, you're making them track bathroom breaks and all kinds of crazy stuff in the system, it's reasonable that people push back on this. So sort of the stepping stone, I think, is explaining to people why, right? Like, a lot of people just simply tell them that they need to do these things. And that's not untrue, but at least explaining to people why you need the data. And I'm not just trying to be a tyrant, but I actually want to understand how your time is leveraged and whether or not I can make life better for you by repositioning something or eliminating meetings that are unnecessary and gobble up a bunch of your time. So the why is particularly important. And then some level of training and education to make things easier, I think, is really, really helpful, because the higher the friction point in managing your time and your energy, the more reasonable type of pushback that you're going to get from your staff. And then after that, it just becomes coaching and management, right? Like, a lot of people will unreasonably tolerate the misbehavior and the nonconformity around the expectations of the role, right? Like, we're all professionals working in a professional industry. And my expectation is that you can track your time as a fundamental administrative component of your job. And a lot of companies just don't enforce that. And then they're frustrated by the fact that they don't have good data. Yet, you know, they're letting people kind of get away with this. And one of my favorite descriptions about a company culture is your culture is defined by what you tolerate, right? It's not what you try to enforce on people or tell them what things are. It's the lowest common denominator. If you let people get away with this stuff and just sort of let the tail wag the dog on time entry and things like that, then of course you're not going to get compliance around it, because humans naturally follow the path of least resistance. They have no incentive to enter time, and they have all the incentive if there's no downside for not doing it. So that, I think, is a huge component to this. And then just using metrics and understanding what your benchmarks are and looking for areas of improvement. I'm a huge data nerd, so dashboarding and reporting, and then helping people to improve their lives and coach them on how to do better so that everyone can perform better together. Because ultimately, people want to be a part of a high performance and a successful team. Like, no one wants to be on the losing team. And people will look around and see, you know, what is the level of effort from everyone else around me? And they, you know, you'll occasionally have some high flyers in some organizations, but you know, if 50% of the staff is just not doing the things that are expected, then, you know, what can you expect from the rest of the people, right?
So when you start talking about tracking time and everything like that, what is a percentage of their day do you say needs to be logged? When I was working with another couple other companies that will remain nameless for security reasons, you know, they would always say, you know, anywhere between 80 and 85% of your daily activities need to be logged in the ticketing platform. You know, that way you can get away from, you know, you had a quick chat down the hall with a production guy, you're using the restroom, you know, whatever the case is, you know, but 80 or 85% of your time is actively logged. And the part B of that question, I know at least in the cybersecurity space, we're having a massive issue getting good talent. When I was in the MSP space, we knew that there was a bunch of pizza techs, trunk slammers. Their idea of security is a pfSense router, performs the same thing as a DoD grade, you know, Palo Alto or Fortinet, which I just want to start whipping people with a wiffle bat because it's not. How much do you think of that the lack of talent and getting good talent is allowing owners to, you know, look the other way when trying to get these type of metrics?
The first part around kind of expectations, you know, 70 to 75% utilization is achievable. Anything past 80% is law of diminishing returns, where you're risking burnout. But, you know, reasonably 5.5 hours, 6 hours of the day should be logged against utilized time, which is basically time that creates value for the client or for the internal company. And then the rest of it is just generally waste, right? Like, I don't go down the rabbit hole of tracking every 15 minutes of time and trying to figure out where that stuff goes, unless you're trying to split sort of this admin bucket into smaller buckets and figure out kind of where is that time going. There's a reporting exercise that can be done, but it shouldn't be the default. It should be, if we're trying to figure out why a person is 50% utilized, where does the other 50% of the time go? Is it just simply waste where they enter admin time, answered emails and was on the phone or talked to other people? Like, that's just a waste bucket. And that's generally fine as long as it's within the standards of what you expect for the role. So yes, it's a reasonable expectation, and that 70 to 75% is totally achievable. As far as whether or not you should sort of let that slide in order to have a better quality of life for the staff, there's maybe a small argument to be made there. But honestly, you know, everyone's replaceable. There's a huge open sea of potential labor that is available. And, you know, quite frankly, no one is irreplaceable from a knowledge standpoint or a skill set standpoint. Every MSP that you go into that has not had a focused effort on the sort of the management policies of an organization has at least one person that is usually one of the more senior, that's been around forever, that is just not subject to any of the policies that everyone else is subject to. And they manage to get away with it. And this comes back to that idea of being careful of what you tolerate in the business. And sure, you know, you may feel like, well, I can't get rid of this person because they're really good at what they do, and maybe I wouldn't be able to find somebody else. And I think there's some truth to that, but it's not nearly as true as people think. Right? If you got someone who is even 60% as qualified, you spent 6 months trying to train them up to be as good as the other person, and they got up to 70 to 75% of the capabilities of that other person, and they had a better attitude and were more compliant with the administrative policies, everyone would be better off. So I think it's taking an intentional approach about this. And what I find almost categorically when I go into other organizations to support them with the implementation of a management framework, there's a simple rule of 50% of the people, after you tell them to do something, they'll be like, okay, sounds good, I'll go do that. There's about 20 to 30% of the people that, you know, they kick and scream a little bit, but you have some conversations with them, you convince them, you sort of sway them around on this idea. They're like, okay, I don't love it, but sure, I get it. Okay, yeah, let's do this. And then there's that 15 to 20% of the staff that just like dig their heels in and piss and moan and just refuse to get on board. And those people can either choose to find another job or they're going to get fired. And it's odd that this is such a consistent thing in most organizations. With you've never taken a focused effort to the development and the management of your staff, you're going to find that this sort of works out this way. And other thing that I tend to find is they're that person that that person that gets away with this stuff, that the old timer that's been around forever, and you know, no one can figure out what he does, and he's magical about some things. When he eventually leaves or gets fired, the rest of the staff kind of breathes a sigh of relief and said, "Man, that should have happened a long time ago." And you know, maybe it's rough for a month or two, but everyone finds that they're better off as a result of that change.
Yeah, that last part describes like most of my jobs, where I'm just the rambunctious freaking a-hole. I think that's why I'm a good pen tester now, because I just like to go around breaking stuff.
Todd, how often, if ever, have you gone in to your clients to help them operationally? Because I'm willing to bet the problems I have as a IT service provider, business owner, are not that different from those of my clients or anyone else down the client chain.
Yeah, you're 100% right, for sure. You know, honestly, I started my business to help owners and operators of businesses be better managers, because the stat is people work an average of 12 years before they get any type of management training, which is crazy. Like I joke that, you know, we would require someone to have some level of certification to be a book manager. Like, you know, you should have a CPA or an accounting degree or something before you're managing someone's book of any significant size. But you'll give them a $2 million business unit worth of labor and just say, "I'm sure you'll do fine. Let me know if you have any questions." And like, that's madness to me. And the truth is like, management sucks in most businesses. Like, that's just a universal truth, right? The MSP, my focus in MSPs comes largely just from, it's an industry that I love. It's an industry that I'm recognized in and have some experience in. But the policy and the management framework that I ascribe to has almost nothing to do with it being an IT industry. The benchmarking and the dashboarding, sure, like you got to understand sort of what good looks like in your industry. So that those parts might be different, but how you actually coach, manage people and develop a great internal high performance culture, that is pretty universal for sure. To your question, I've never really sort of gone into clients of my clients, but I have in some circumstances gotten referrals from the MSPs that I work with to other companies that are not that are either clients of those MSPs or just sort of friends of their of those MSPs and helped out some other companies that are outside of the IT space for sure.
The reason I ask is because I think your productivity course could be helpful across the board. But again, I don't know if it's tailored towards the MSP, but there are many companies out there that if we could get them squared away operationally, it would make our jobs as IT providers so much easier, because now, you know, they have a playbook of who is in charge of what. And when it comes time to make incident response plans or what have you, we know where to go as a provider. And, you know, we're not running around like a chicken without its head kind of thing.
Yeah, I've certainly considered it, kind of making some of these, the courses that I'm building more applicable in a broader base. Right now, they're built in a way that sort of the language that I use and what I talk about in the courses is very IT industry specific. I've considered whether or not I rework them and make them more broadly applicable. It's just the difficulty and why I don't sort of pursue that right now is that the management consulting industry is, like the MSP industry, is highly competitive, and there's a million people out there doing what I do. And in a lot of cases, it's easier to specialize and sort of have a niche than to just sort of compete more broadly, right? But I agree with you. Like, there's a lesson there as well, Shiva, about the role that the MSP should be playing in consulting with the business owners. And you know, we talk a lot about kind of the TBR and QBR cycle, and that the term that everyone loves to hate, the trusted advisor. There's a lot of work.
I hate that term. Does anyone have a better term? Don't mind me. Go ahead.
Yeah. What's the better term for trusted advisor? Anyone have a preference? I'm willing to be called an idiot.
Quite honestly, like I'm the IT idiot to my clients. But I mean, go ahead. Don't mind me.
Yeah. So I think the important point is like the MSP channel has gotten a lot more sophisticated over the last 5 years and are kind of getting keen to the idea around business management and high performance teams and those things, and which is awesome. But it's one of the cool things about the MSP channel in general is that they're very supportive, and there's a high level of community where people are willing to share, and they're not territorial and kind of keeping secrets from each other, which is awesome. And I think that there's a lot that we know and have spent time on that is of value to the organizations that we do IT for. And the easiest entry point that I sort of advise people on this is just simply sort of business efficiency in leveraging technology better. Like, how do you use Teams? How do you use SharePoint or other file sharing technologies? Like, there's simple entry points. You know, how do you think about the labor efficiency of your business? Like, what are the software tools or BI tools, like business intelligence tools that you're using in your business that could be applicable? You know, simple upgrades to, you know, accounting software, to, you know, maybe switching to Dynamics CRM. Those types of opportunities are pretty prolific in a lot of industries. And that's what we've seen from the pandemic is a forced acceleration of digital transformation. And that's a big term that tends to get thrown around by CIOs and enterprise and stuff like that. But I think there's a high applicability to the MSP industry and our channel around digital transformation and the opportunities that it creates for consultative relationships with the clients.
You know, I know part of what you do also is helping, you know, service managers at MSPs and IT providers be more effective in what they do. Is there a point where you're leading them more down to at least being aware of the cybersecurity incidents that are going on, where they can help identify what they're seeing on the front lines of a service desk and kick it up to whether that MSP has a CISO or if they're outsourcing their security?
Yes. So cybersecurity awareness, interestingly, is the courses are often built for the end users on the client side around like what does a phishing attempt look like and all of those things. There's some internal knowledge that's applicable there, but I have in the background, I'm building a small course. It's just kind of a quick course around how MSP techs should think about security, and it's a bit about sort of what the industry threat looks like, why MSPs are such a high risk vector for phishing and things like that, you know, why the risk is so much higher than it ever has been, and just generally some things that you should think about, like 2FA all things, right? Like simple stuff all the way up to, you know, what are some things you should think about when you're building technical infrastructure, and what are some of the base security pieces around this? And this is not meant to compete with like the industry security training, because what I found is like you can go get Security Plus and CISSP courses, which is really, really detailed and exhaustive training, which is incredibly useful. But if you're just talking about a level one or a level two tech in an MSP, that's not the type of security training that they need. They just need the basic fundamentals of how should I think about security and exactly that. Like, what do I identify? Like, one of the questions that I have in there is, if a senior tech tells you to leave a system logged in and with an administrative user because there's a line of business software that requires it, what do?
You call Eric and say, come on in.
Exactly. And that's the point. It's like one of there's a couple of responses to this, the sort of multiple choice question. And one of them is just like, tell them get bent and log the machine out because that's what you should do. And technically that's the right answer, but it's also the wrong approach because then you've now broken the line of business software for the company. So it's tricky. Like, you got to basically take it up to management and say, this is not a good way to run this piece of software. We need to advise the client that this is a terrible idea and we should figure out some way to fix this, right? So that's sort of like the seeds that you want to plant is just general security awareness and not necessarily actioning it, but just being able to call things out when you see them, right?
So, I mean, there's this is the conversations that we're having with a lot of folks, you know, where security must meet, you know, operational functionability, right? You can't lock it down so much where you can't operate your freaking business, but you can't let a bunch of freaking line of business apps freaking dictate the security of the security posture of your business either. We have, you know, a wide gamut of different clients in the manufacturing and, you know, accounting and just all this other stuff. But you have to start like, okay, you guys are going to use this line of business app. We all know on this table that it's the biggest piece of crap known to man. It's full of vulnerabilities. It's got these problems. You guys are now off in your own little bucket, in your own little VLAN, and y'all can just play kumbaya over there, and you're going to stay out of the rest of this freaking network. The one thing I want to ask you is when you're starting to advise MSPs around cybersecurity, are you getting to the point where you're going to start telling them or advising them on some questions when they come up to a Yahoo like me, how to handle me? What questions should they be asking a cybersecurity firm? Do they really know what the fuck a pen test really means? Or are you looking for a vulnerability scanner? I can't tell you how many times even this week I've had 3 calls. We want a penetration test. What exactly do you want? Oh, we just want to see what's open. No, that's not a penetration test. But what is a penetration test? You're asking me to steal your crap and show it to you. One of the biggest things I harp on, there's plenty of people in your space that are advising on cybersecurity, but they're not advising properly. But, you know, it's one of my biggest soapboxes that I get on. Are you advising them how to deal with a cybersecurity firm?
Not directly. This is where sort of I'm relying on the experts, right? So like I said, I have some industry partners that I trust more broadly in this space. And, you know, what I tell people is, do you want to build this internally? And like we said at the top, that does not mean just going out and buying some software and, you know, wash your hands and you're done. This means spending years building up the training and the sophistication of someone or multiple people within the company to really, really understand this and become a security expert so that they can better understand the different components of a security policy, a security approach. And if you're not willing to do that, then you need to rely on the third parties that can give you sort of better direction on that. And so, as I said, I'm deferring to the experts in this space, but I have seen enough of what you're talking about where, for example, I occasionally have like industry people that are not in IT come to me and say, I'd like to get a security scan. And then you dig a little deeper and they're building a web app and they need someone to actually like do some compliance testing and some actual penetration testing. And again, like all of these terms get very confused, quite rightly, by people that are not in this channel. So, you know, don't rely on someone who knows enough to be dangerous like me. You need to rely on someone who has some level of sophistication, hopefully some credential around this, and it can carry some level of expertise, right?
So I want to push back on you just a little bit and kind of circle or back around to the topic here. So, you know, everybody knows Robin Robbins. You know, we're not about to slam her, so nobody starts, you know, emailing her, please. But I'm not sure she still does it or not, but for a long time, her claim to fame with a lot of MSPs was, you know, the 7 or 8 things every business owner should be asking an IT firm. What I'm asking you is, are you creating a list, something like that, what every MSP should be asking a cybersecurity firm?
Me personally, no, I'm not. Because as I said, I don't know enough about this industry because I don't know enough. Like if someone wanted to help me build it, sure. But, you know,
that's
like,
one of the most honest answers I've ever heard about cybersecurity in my life. Kudos to you for that one, man.
Well, like I said at the top, like this is an area of the biggest risks are the unknown unknowns. And there's a lot I don't know about cybersecurity. There's enough that I know about it. Like I said, like I'm building basic security training for level 1 and level 2, which is enable 2FA, don't use shitty passwords. Here's what a good password looks like. These are the things that you should think about in building security. Those are all fundamentals and largely based on infrastructure. But if we get into like, what does NIST mean? What are the important parts of a CIS policy? What is the difference between MDR and other types of security response? Is it active versus passive MDR? Like those are some of the simple ones. Like a lot of people think that I hire an MDR firm and that means that, you know, I have somebody who's going to jump on top of any security issue that pops up and they'll take care of it for me.
Which, yeah, we know somebody like that.
Yeah, and in most cases, all they do is say, hey, this looks bad. Somebody should take a look at this, right? Like that's the extent of their involvement, right? So it's a crazy industry that is, you know, it's rightly confusing because I've been in the IT industry all my life. Like I had my first consulting company before I graduated high school. And I am quite, I'm quite comfortable to say I don't know enough about security to be able to advise people directly about security, right? Like I'm going to give you some things to think about around how you approach this, but then absolutely defer to the expert.
How do you feel about legacy systems for your clients and your clients letting their clients run legacy systems? Now, to define what a legacy system is, to me, that is a system you're too goddamn cheap to upgrade. So you keep running it way beyond its life.
Yeah, I would say there's one other circumstance. Like you see this a lot in shipping companies. If they do logistics or freight of some kind, there's often an XP machine that is like sectioned off on the floor because it has to print labels or something. And like the vendor literally does not support an upgrade.
I don't buy that though. I mean,
neither do I. Just, but that's what the vendors say.
That's just perpetuating bullshit.
But I see where this comes from because I spent a lot of my early IT career in oil and gas and insurance, which are two industries that are absolutely ripe with legacy systems.
And shit money. I mean, they literally shit money.
Yeah, but like, look at the Colonial Pipeline ransom event, right? Like the SCADA systems, security event monitoring systems for like pipe flow and pressure controls and things like that, they were on a completely segregated network managed by a different IT group altogether. We were not allowed to touch them. Right. And it's because they're highly specialized. If there is alarms or, if to shut down a pipe for some reason, it costs literally hundreds of thousands of dollars an hour. And a lot of those systems run on legacy equipment because, the vendors are old, antiquated, and in a lot of cases don't exist anymore. Like we did a consolidation project when we were doing a merger between two oil and gas companies. We found 20,000 individual pieces of software installed between both companies. We were able to rationalize it down to 1,200 through a 1.5 year project. And we still had systems that were built literally by a guy in his garage that had gone out of business 5 years ago, but it was a critical system that was required for the business to operate, right? And like those are giant companies that absolutely have enough money to spend on this, but maybe either a lack of option or a lack of imagination don't have any options to get away from some of that stuff. I think in most cases, you're right. It's just like, it works. I don't want to touch it. Just leave it alone is typical. But honestly, there are some situations where it's a shit industry and there's no alternatives, unfortunately.
Granted, that's true for oil and gas. I mean, their scale is out of the area of operation for an MSP. Typical MSP is not even coming close to something half that size or a quarter that size.
Yep.
The average MSP is dealing with, a 5 user to maybe 1,000.
Right.
And when you're getting into CNC machines that use line of business applications, that's just because someone in that end business has a sunken cost fallacy.
Yep.
And they think they can't do better. And if they were to upgrade, they'd probably save money on the power it takes to run the machine, the support cost, and they'd be more secure, especially with insurers running for the hills these days. Although I don't think the insurers are going to say that publicly after what happened to AXA the day after they announced no more cybersecurity coverage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is. I think you're right to highlight this as well. There's a lot of the insurance industry that are just saying like this is so hot we can't even touch it. Like getting cybersecurity policies has become problematic for a lot of organizations that haven't had sort of an existing policy, and kind of coming to renewal time, they're like, what do you mean my policy rate has gone up like 1,500%? Right? Because, another week, another ransomware event, and they're getting a lot more sophisticated and a lot more expensive. The risk around this stuff is insane, for sure.
I think a lot of the cyber insurance industry is going to come back in, and they're going to make it a self-attestation model. They're going to give you a list of whether it's 10 or 100 questions. They're going to ask you to answer it. They're not going to ask you for the proof. And then if you come to file a claim, that's when they're going to go back to your application and say, okay, show us this, 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 and this. Oh, you don't have it? You didn't have it in place? Yeah, you're denied.
And yeah, denied claims, a huge, huge increase of that for sure.
And that's how the insurance companies really make their money, right?
Yeah.
They look for ways to not pay out on the claims.
Yeah, I was asked this recently, and I'm sort of curious about where this is going to go, because the output around the Colonial issue, I saw an article, I haven't dug into it yet, maybe you guys have seen this, where DHS is actually suggesting that there is compliance that has to be in place for a lot of these systems now. And this is sort of like the thin edge of regulation coming into the industry. I've been on record as saying, like, I don't think regulation of MSPs is practical because it's such a huge industry. And how do you actually validate this with any reasonable assurance, right? So I don't think that regulation is practical, but I think there's going to be some type of sort of policy and compliance leading towards regulation. And maybe over like a 10 or 20 year period, this becomes more concrete. What do you guys think?
I think in terms of regulation and using DHS in the pipeline, they are going to regulate industries, and especially industries that are critical to national infrastructure. And Eric and I spoke about this, I think, last week, that I think in the case of Colonial, the government should have stepped in and privatized them. I know that's a bad thought. No one wants to hear that. But if you can declare a state of emergency in 17 states because of the Colonial issue, then the government could step in, take over the pipeline, bring everything up to scratch, technology-wise, cybersecurity-wise, and then go back and send the bill to the operators. So to answer your question, I think, yes, they can regulate, but they can't regulate us. I think what they can do is regulate the industry, like the oil and gas, if you're producing, you know, if you're a national supplier. Put the regulations there, because there are too many different types of IT providers out there. It's almost like the doctors. You have radiologists, rheumatologists, general practitioners. You have to leave that to us, because we know the insurance companies can't do it with how CNA got popped, AXA got popped, and many insurance brokers continue to get popped on a daily basis, as I'm sure Eric can attest. Circling back to what you asked, it's going to be industry specific.
But can we please, God, make it actually enforceable?
Not if it's self-attestation.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, even the HIPAA is not self-attestation, but...
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Everything in HIPAA is... Are you doing this? Yes. It's not, are you doing this? Send the proof. And that's the same thing for most of the compliance sets out there. I will go out on a limb and say most compliance is just the illusion of control, so that someone can say, we did this, but they're not doing it. Todd, how many of your clients, when you first meet them, won't spend the money to really secure their house? But after you get through with them and you show them the story of what could happen, they're probably like, yeah, we're going to spend that money now.
The sophistication and the maturity of their approach varies pretty wildly, for sure.
Todd, do you want to tell everyone how they can reach out and get to you?
Sure. I have a weekly email and a fairly regular podcast. You can find me on LinkedIn, Twitter.
What's your Twitter?
Todd A. Kane, K-A-N-E. LinkedIn is where more of the professional stuff is. You can just search for me, Todd Kane. It's mostly professional. Twitter is not so much. And my website, easiest URL to find is itisabusiness.com. You can go there and then you can see sort of list of services and links to the blog and the podcast and my email list as well, and the courses as well, if you're interested in the productivity course or the service manager course.
And how often is your podcast releasing episodes?
It's irregular. It's sometimes it's a couple a month, and sometimes it's one a month. So it's a labor of love. I do it whenever I'm keen to have a guest on, essentially.
Any closing questions for Eric?
Nah, I appreciate the time today, Todd. It's been pretty informative. A little bit of banter going back and forth on this one, and look forward to talking to you further in future episodes.
Awesome. Appreciate it, guys.
Thank you, guys. Thanks again for joining us for the Cybersecurity Amplified and Intensified podcast.